Hello, and welcome to Agents of Nonprofit. My name is Alexander Lapa, and I'm here to speak with everyday superheroes helping nonprofits using technology. Joining me today is Kevin Christopher George, and we're going to talk about point versus platform, long-term versus short-term approaches to technology. Kevin, welcome to the show.
Alex, thanks so much for having me. Appreciate the opportunity to spend time with you. Looking forward to a good conversation.
Absolutely. So, to get started, I'm curious to know your superhero origin story. How did you get started working in the non-tech industry?
Yeah, sure. It's an interesting, I guess, kind of origin story. I mean, I've kind of always been steeped in tech, even coming out of like high school. I was one of the lucky people that figured out what they wanted to do pretty early on, due to some influential teachers that I had as I was growing up. And so my whole entire career, I started off at a large pharmaceutical device supplier in their IT department, managing projects, then managing servers, doing disaster recovery scenarios, working on the balanced scorecard with their director of IT, all that good IT operational stuff when I was kind of first coming out of post-secondary. And then I moved into mobile devices when I worked at BlackBerry for almost 7 years, kind of bouncing back and forth between Canada and the States, educating people on hardware, on encryption, on security, on device management. And then I made the switch and got into the cloud tech arena at organizations like Oracle and Coupa, where I was a customer success manager. And I think it was working as a customer success manager where I really started to dive into the value of technology, kind of seeing what happens throughout the entire sales life cycle and how organizations adopt and use technology. And through that experience as a CSM, helping organizations get more and more value out of the solutions they purchased from these SaaS companies, it was interesting because I started to find that I wanted to spend more time taking all this experience and knowledge and learnings that I had and applying it to organizations that I had a personal or attachment or their values aligned with my own. So in November of 2021, I decided to take a step back from the kind of for-profit corporate cloud technology space. And I started up Green Merits Consulting, or I should say relaunched Green Merits Consulting, with a focus on how do I help nonprofits adopt, like research and then adopt and then analyze data with respect to cloud applications and solutions. And the end result is like, yeah, now I'm working with organizations where, you know, I'm more jazzed about working with them because I see the good things that they're trying to do in the world. And that kind of resonates with me and it makes me feel excited about helping them out. And they're doing some really cool things. So it's been an interesting kind of roller coaster ride, starting off with, you know, IT operational stuff, then hardware, then cloud, and then switching into the nonprofit sector and having a whole bunch of different challenges as compared to the for-profit sector.
We had a conversation, I guess it's a few months now, when we first introduced ourselves. And what I remember clearly from that conversation I was really impressed with was the fact that you reached a moment in your life where you wanted to be more intentional with what you do. Right. You wanted to be more, to really make a choice, an active choice, and not just have the market dictate or push you in a certain direction. You said, look, where do I really want to invest my time, my energy? How do I want to help? And who do I want to help? And you made that direction, that choice, or the outcome of that direction was towards nonprofits. And I thought that was tremendous insight, and I respect you for that.
I appreciate that. And my wife and I mean, there was a lot of planning that went to it. I think the perception, I think that I've, or the feedback I've gotten from a lot of folks, like, oh, you're part of that great resignation thing, right? And it's like, it kind of just happened to coincide with, you know, the kind of COVID-related great resignation that took place. This move towards being much more intentional with our time, both myself and my wife, and focusing on things that really resonate with us and where we want to spend our time and energy and effort. It's part of a plan that's been going on for the past 5 years or so. Lots of podcasts, lots of books, lots of changes in, you know, financials and spending habits and things like this. But it ended up culminating to a spot where both of us actually were able to say, okay, you know what, we're going to take a step back and let's focus on what we're really interested in, passionate about, where we think we can make the biggest impact, and let's pull the trigger and do it. And that happened to be November 2021 for me, and for my wife, it was January of 2022.
Oh, so there's a lag between the two of you.
Just a slight one, yeah.
But in lag in the decision-making process or the execution process?
Just execution.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Awesome. No, I mean, whatever the choice, we chose nonprofits for XYZ reasons. You know, whatever the outcome of your decision is, the idea of being intentional with where you want to spend your time, I guess that's part of the reason why there was a resignation. How do I say this? It's probably the most important part. It's the idea of realizing that you have a certain amount of time and you want to make sure you allocate that time into doing things that you love doing and not on things you don't like doing. So just, you know, sitting and taking a moment to reflect, to pause, to analyze, and then make that decision. And then in your case, you know, actually doing it and following through and succeeding. So awesome.
Yeah. Yeah. Thanks. It's been a wild ride, but loving every minute of it so far.
Yeah. Okay. So let's talk about tech. And one of the first topics I wanted to jump into was considering tech as an investment, which is interesting because when you normally think of the word investment, you think of something that you buy and that will appreciate in value. Cars are not an investment because they lose value. Houses are usually an investment because they do generally, at least over the long time period, increase in value. So how would you consider tech to be an investment?
Yeah. It's an interesting question. I mean, so when I look at technology and even just kind of, you know, as you kind of alluded to, the whole kind of definition of investment. So you're putting up some kind of cost, energy, effort, typically some kind of dollars up front with the hope that over time it's going to appreciate in value. And I mean, appreciate in value, make you do more, save money down the road. You're going to get some kind of positive benefit as time progresses because you made that initial decision to make that investment or put that outlay of cost. And I view tech in the same way. And there can be bad investments in tech and there could be good investments in tech, right? When I think about an investment in tech, we've identified a problem or a challenge or an opportunity that we think we can address now and will have some type of benefit to us over the long term. So we're willing to part ways with, you know, some level of dollars, and it can translate that in any way, right? It could be number of hours spent, and that translates to a salary of some people that are working on a project, but there's some kind of outlay up front. And the hope is that over time, you're going to reap the rewards of making that initial investment. I think that concept is kind of universal. When we talk about it from a technology standpoint, we're talking about, you know, the ones and zeros, the cloud software, the hardware that's going to help us achieve that value later on. So I view technology as an investment. And like I alluded to, you know, there can be good ones and there can be bad ones.
So then let's talk about the good ones and the bad ones.
Sure.
How would an organization, let's say a nonprofit specifically, what kind of research can a nonprofit do to be able to avoid the bad ones and be attracted to the good ones?
Yeah. And this is one of the things that I try to help my organizations, my clients out with when it comes to making some of these decisions. Oftentimes it's, you know, we don't know what we don't know and help us out. A lot of it comes down to, I think, digital literacy. I think that's a good kind of underpinning to doing that kind of research. Like really understanding what you're getting involved in when you start to look at, and for me, it's all about cloud software, right? So when you're starting to look at cloud applications and you're starting to figure out, you know, who the different players are, the different vendors that can provide the functionality or say they can provide the functionality that you're looking for. Do you understand kind of the model? Do you understand some of the things that could potentially go into a contract you're going to sign? Do you understand what integrations may or may not look like and how that impacts other areas of your organization? So there's this kind of underlying kind of base level of not even knowledge, but comfort, like even the ability to go and find out that type of detail if you need. And that sets up a good foundation to be in a position where you can say, okay, I'm ready to do like a scan of the environment. I know I've got this particular problem or opportunity or challenge. I'm going to start going out and looking at different vendors and hopefully future partners that can help me out with this particular opportunity or challenge. Now, there's a bunch of resources out there. There's the Capteras, the G2s that can, you know, provide a snapshot, I guess, of a comparison between different vendors out there. That can sometimes give you a starting point to help you understand who's out there, kind of how well they're rated generally. There's a lot of sites that provide that kind of insight. I think in the nonprofit sector, one thing that, you know, I've got mixed feelings about it, but I'll throw this out there. Organizations talk to each other and are very clear and open and honest and frank about, you know, what's worked and what hasn't. And I think that can be a good thing in the nonprofit sector. I'm thinking about a client that I'm working with right now who actually had another nonprofit organization join the digital transformation like roadmap call to talk to the Sterco about the experiences that they had at their organization and like pitfalls to avoid and things to watch out for. So I think that element of being able to talk to others in your industry or in your sphere and really get your arms wrapped around what their experience was, if and how it differs from yours, I think that helps get you on the right path towards making a decision about how you're going to shortlist who you're going to reach out to. The final piece is talking to the vendors themselves, right? Like, so you can do all this, you know, you do your online research, you talk to your buddies and your folks in your network about, you know, what solutions are out there and what they can do, especially from a perspective of how's it going to help us alleviate whatever pain or challenge we're trying to overcome. The last piece is you got to go, you got to start talking to vendors, right? And, you know, vendors/partners, because at that point they got to, you know, show you what their stuff is made of, right? They're going to either be able to give you the functionality or they're not, or meet some of it, but not all of it, right? And I think as a nonprofit organization, you have to be comfortable with having those conversations. For those smaller nonprofits that may not have like dedicated in-house IT expertise, sometimes it's beneficial to go out and get a third-party person to come in to say, okay, you know what, help us out with this RFP process. Be on the phone with us when we're talking with this vendor. Help us review the contract to make sure that, you know, we're signing up for the stuff that they showed us in the demonstrations. Those are all the key pieces that I would say you need to consider as you're going out and trying to make a sound decision about technology adoption.
And talking about the RFP process, so request for proposal, is that something you normally see when an organization needs to build out certain functionality? Or do you see this kind of informal process where they're, like you said, starting with scanning, talking to others, talking to vendors, and doing it more in-house and doing it more for a specific need as opposed to the RFP process, which is generally, we got this really big project, we don't really know how to approach it, so we're looking for outside guidance to handhold us through the entire process.
I've seen kind of two flavors. I've seen the RFP process be really an opportunity to be really methodical and quantitative about making the decision around which technology partner you're going to partner with, you're going to shack up with, right? It's an opportunity to say, okay, like here is clearly what we need out of your solution, like row by row by row, and then being able to you know, adequately score it. And then weight those scores accordingly. There is benefit to the RFP process if you have the time, energy, effort, and skill to put it together to make it effective. What I've seen in some cases, you know, both on the nonprofit side and on the for-profit side, interestingly, is sometimes the RFP is used as a check in the box, right? Where it's like, hey, well, we have to go out to get three vendors. We already know that we want to go with this one, but the rules dictate that we have to put together, you know, an RFP that's going to go to these three. And I think there's, I don't know if there's pros and cons to it. Maybe it's part of just, you know, due process and due diligence. But I've seen that as well, where it's more of a check in the box effort. I question the amount of time and energy and effort that goes into it, along with, you know, are you putting vendors through an exercise that, you know, at the end of the day, they don't stand a chance in winning. So I think there's some concern around that. And I think that's why some vendors struggle with RFPs, right? And I question how much that weighs into the overall relationship kind of further down the line. But separate from that, I think there is value to RFPs, but I do see struggles in trying to go with that process for the smaller nonprofits, which is why sometimes they've got to farm it out or pull in experts to help out with kind of guiding them through it.
Can you think of any downsides to an RFP process as opposed to doing self-research? I guess I get the total check in the box, and I'm not going to touch that one because that's a deep dive that we could talk for a while. But I mean, in order for an RFP to be really effective, the right vendor has to be in the mix. And it's possible, I'm thinking of a scenario where, you know, the RFP is put out, a handful of vendors say, you know, raise their hand, but none of them are really, let's say, the objectively best choice for that situation. And if the nonprofit had done their own research, they might have found the best vendor on their own accord. Is there any risk to that? Or is generally RFPs, if you can do it and you can go through the process and you can be honest about it, that generally is the best approach for almost every situation?
So I would say that, again, depending on time, resources, and urgency within which the project needs to be completed, RFPs are a good kind of quantitative way to articulate kind of the feelings and perceptions that a nonprofit might have about a particular group of vendors. I don't think that takes away from the fact that the nonprofit should still do some of the legwork up front to do that, what I referred to before, is kind of like an industry scan or a competitive scan to see who is out there. Like, who are the ones that are at the top of the list, right? And again, understanding that those lists aren't definitive, but I think my guidance would be, you know, if you're going out and doing an industry scan to take a look at, you know, CRM vendors, you're probably going to find that, you know, there's a good top like 5 or 6 that are highly rated across the board, all these different review sites, right? Now, I would leave it up to the nonprofit if they want to expand that. And again, this is up to, you know, time and resources if they want to add more vendors to that list. But I think doing that initial research up front gives them enough compelling information to say, okay, you know, we've done the industry scan. We know that there's 30 different, you know, CRM vendors or email campaign vendors or whatever you want to call it. But based on our research, we've whittled it down. And especially thinking about time and resources, we've brought it down to these 5 that we're going to go after. I think that's reasonable. And I think boards and, you know, executive directors, I think they would be fine with that approach, understanding that, you know, it does take a lot of time and effort to go through an RFP process with a lot of different vendors. The other thing you got to think about, Alex, too, is like the more vendors that are including these RFPs, the more questions that are going to be asked of the nonprofit organization to clarify things, the more reviews that are going to have to be done with the answers that they provide, more demonstrations potentially. This is why sometimes we see multiple phases of the RFP where, you know, round one is going to have, you know, 10 vendors. And then after, based on that, we're going to shortlist it down to like 3. So I've seen that approach as well, right? It's like industry scan, round one for the RFP, and then round two for the RFP. Again, takes a bit more time and energy and effort, but that's another approach to rolling out a successful RFP if you've got the power to do it.
So yeah, you're talking a bit more about selected RFP instead of being an open-ended type of RFP where anyone can apply. Yes. Yeah, doing the initial research, already having a short list, so to speak, and then saying you've been chosen to participate in the RFP if you so choose to do so. Yeah, that totally makes sense to me. And then before I say a nonprofit makes a final choice, I know this is going to be a vague question, but I'll do my best to narrow the scope down a little bit.
Sure.
The general question is, you know, as a nonprofit is going to invest in technology, and this is going to be a digital transformation of some kind, what are some high level but critical questions that a nonprofit organization should ask themselves to make sure that the outcome of the RFP process or whatever process you go through will match what you're looking for?
Yeah. So that's a very big question. So, and I'll put on given kind of where my career kind of led me to as a customer success manager. And it was cool because I was involved in those digital transformation initiatives with the clients that I was working with. I'll say this, the clients that I worked with, and this is what I'm trying to instill in the nonprofits that I work with now, the ones that had the most or the highest success rate when it comes to like functionality that they required, but also in terms of, I'm not going to say adherence to the RFP, but like a good match between the specs required and the use cases that needed to be met or fulfilled. They were clients that had a clear understanding of not just the features they needed, but the value that those particular features were purported to bring or required to bring. So I put on the hat of like clearly understand the pain points, where possible, quantify them as much as possible in terms of time, efficiency savings, you know, increased opportunity, whatever it may be. And if you start from that perspective of this is what success looks like to us, this is what our requirements are for success, you can then start to structure the RFP and the requirements within the RFP and tie those different features to the success criteria. The clients that I've worked with in the past, the ones that were able to articulate that and come ready with that and be ready to talk about that, like, we need the following 5 features because, you know, this rolls up to how we report the following. When we were able to have that conversation, that was a much more partner-focused conversation, but it really showed that the client was coming from a perspective of, like, we need this stuff, not just because it's shiny and new, but because it's actually going to contribute to the following success criteria that we have. And that dictated the RFP. It dictated how we would respond to an RFP. It dictated the language that we use and the things that we'd present during demonstrations, right? It would dictate things that were talked about during quarterly business reviews after they had bought the solution, and we'd be talking about new features and things coming out. those conversations that were focused on success criteria were much more impactful as opposed to the ones that were just focused on specific features that, you know, they wanted. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that makes total sense. I mean, even myself in my own services, I am always about the outcome. You know, what is the goal? What are we trying to achieve? And that's what I want to be measured on, not the effort or the inputs. It's right. You know, what are the success metrics and how do we achieve them? But have we achieved them is the most important question.
Right. And I kind of alluded to this. I think that really does set up, and you've heard me kind of use, you know, vendor, partner kind of interchangeably, but like you share that level of insight about what's going to make you successful and where your pain points are and challenges are. And that conversation is much more indicative, or one that you would have with a true partner. So you throw an RFP out to vendors, right? And you say, okay, like answer these questions. But I just feel sometimes that is very, you're over there, we're over here. Whereas if you're a nonprofit organization and you're ready to sit down and really get into the weeds about the challenges that you're facing and what you need to be successful, and, you know, the vendor future partner does a good job of listening to those requirements and being able to translate to them into what that means from a technical standpoint, I think that's more indicative of a partnership. Right. And that's why, I like the SaaS model. It's, you know, you're signing on for, you know, typically like a year, 2 year, 3 years, whatever it may look like. There's a relationship there, and that relationship has to be built on that trust and that visibility into, you know, what are you actually trying to get out of the solution? If we just get caught up on, and I've seen this other approach, if we just get caught up on, you know, here's a list of 30 features that just have to be in the platform. It's like, okay, yeah, but like you got to help articulate the why behind those features, help prioritize them and articulate a sense of urgency. And that's a partnership conversation. That's not a vendor conversation. A vendor conversation is, here's our list of 30 features, go fix it and tell us when they're done. Right. Whereas a partner conversation, it's like, no, let's sit down and talk about like why we need this, when we need this, what's it going to impact? How does this affect things further down the road? Like those are the kinds of conversations I like getting into. You can probably hear me talking about it because I chatting about it for a while.
No, the why question is the most important. Why and how, I think, are the most important mm-hmm. questions to ask. Mm-hmm. And you're right, being vulnerable to the idea of exposing your challenges as a nonprofit and then really actively seeking help from a partner and then seeing you as equals, not as an order taker, order right. giver, but a contribution towards a common goal.
Totally. Exactly. Exactly.
So this next question I'm curious to know, it's a bit of a backwards question, because a lot of people, especially in tech, think that tech can solve all the problems in the world. And being a bit biased, I would say tech can solve a lot of problems. But there are some times where problems can't be solved by tech, but people think that they can be solved by tech. Have you come across any situations, or can you give any examples where an organization says, okay, you know, if we only had the newest whatever tech, then things will be better? And you have to say, hang on a second, this isn't the problem. There's another problem. You know, new tech or different tech is not going to solve your issue. There's something bigger than that or more that has to be resolved first before we can start going toward the new tech. And you can give us an example or a scenario where you've seen that.
Sure. There's probably a few examples that I'm chuckling thinking about them, because when I came across them, especially, you know, earlier in my career, I was like, what are you talking? Like, this solution is awesome. This hardware is awesome. This rollout that we're doing is going to be great for everybody. And like they didn't go through, or they went through, but then things crashed and burned. And you're kind of left scratching your head being like, what's going on here? Like what happened? What did I miss? And I remember very early in my career, one of my managers came to me and said, you know, it's can be people. It can be personalities. It can be fear. These are all kind of people or emotional related kind of challenges that, if you're just thinking about the tech alone, they're easy to overlook, but they can completely, just shut down whatever tech initiative you're trying to put together. I've had projects that failed because the wrong, one person wasn't included on an email. They knew they were told about it anyways, but they weren't included on the initial email. And as a result of that, they want to pull the plug on the whole thing. And like situations like that, when they arise, you're like, oh my gosh, okay, right. Like these were early lessons learned about, okay, everybody's got to be, it's not just everybody has to be included, but people have to feel the need that they're being included because they want to be able to chime in and provide their insights, and they want to be informed about what's going on, right? Like that's more of a people thing. That's not a tech related thing. I've seen challenges with respect to like fear of change, right? Where it's, okay, we've got this awesome new system. Here's all the great things it's going to do. It's going to make everybody's lives easier, better, faster, like all this good stuff. But there's a subset of, you know, the user base or staff, or even in some cases leadership, who are looking at this thinking, okay, well, this is going to be a big change to how I do things. And the things that I was viewed as an expert on, you're going to make that available to like everybody. They can go in and run reports and look at this information that I've kind of got in my head. Like, I'm not sure I really want that. Right. And they might not say it like that, Alex, but I've seen situations where that fear is there based on the types of questions and objections that you get during the conversation. And I think tech folks, I'll call it, need to be sensitive to personalities and fear and ego, right? In some cases, because, you know, overlooking any one of those kind of people related challenges can really undermine, you know, some good things that were, you know, that I think those in the tech sector are trying to do or bring to the nonprofit side of the house. Yeah, that's what I'd say. I think it's the biggest bulk has been people changes or people challenges.
One of the questions I like asking early on in a project is, who is the person we need to convince most?
Sure. Yeah,
Who's going to be the one that if we can get them on our side, it'll be a smoother ride. And usually these are the ones who might sabotage, you know, either on purpose or inadvertently, might sabotage the project. So that if we can get this person to be, you know, a cynic into a cheerleader, then things will just be smoother. It sounds like that's one of the scenarios where that happened to you, or could have happened to you, or should have happened to you, maybe.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, these are the lessons that we learn when we're bright-eyed and bushy-tailed and think that tech can do everything, right? And then you put yourself through the ringer, you take some bumps on the chin, and then you start to realize that, you know, as awesome as technology is and all the great things that it has and can continue to do, for sure, especially in the nonprofit sector and with social impact organizations, people are still people, right? Whether on the for-profit or nonprofit side, and there's going to be personal perceptions or challenges or things that come up that may not have them fully on board with your vision and even their peers' vision. Right. I like what you're saying about, you know, who do I have to convince? Because maybe you've convinced 90% of the organization, but that last 10%, they're the ones that can derail things. Right. So identifying them early on and informing them and keep them, you know, bringing them on board as much as you can. I think that'll only help to increase the success rate of different IT projects that we see going on. Unfortunately, you know, you've seen studies about this, right? Like the majority of these digital transformation initiatives, like they fail. And it's for a whole host of reasons, but the one that kind of stands out with me is some of the people related ones or the emotional kind of related ones that come up, because I think those can be accounted for, dealt with, I guess, use that loosely, through proper communication and a sense of empathy, patience, understanding others' perspective. These are some things that I think I picked up along the way, especially in my CSM days.
It's always easier to tackle a problem when you can see the problem happen before it happens. This is one thing I remember when I started learning how to ride a motorcycle, is when you learn that the top, like the number one accident is when you get T-boned, they call it, at a four-way intersection, you're going straight, the car makes a left turn, smashes into you. Knowing that's the number one motorcycle accident of all time, you can put yourself in a position that every time you cross a four-way intersection, you're much more alert than ever before. So it's the same concept here, right? Where if you know the four or three or four main people blockers up front, you can already start addressing them, you know, asking who is that cynic, for example, who is the person that who's going to resist the change, or who is the person that will lose something as a part of this tech? Because you mentioned to a certain point, some people have a knowledge they don't want to give up and share with others because they feel that they're empowered when they only have that, when they're the only ones that have that knowledge. Is there any other major milestone, you think, or indicator that you need to overcome to be able to help the adoption of a new tech?
Yeah. I mean, so we've kind of touched on a few of them, right? I mean, there's the digital literacy piece, right? Kind of understanding kind of the bare bones about what's involved or what the tech landscape looks like and things to consider. There's the people kind of perception, emotional kind of elements that come into it. I'd say those are probably the big two that I've seen when it comes to, you know, technology transformations that don't succeed. I'm not sure. I think those are the big two. I'm just trying to think through, like, you know, the history of different digital transformations that I've been involved in. And we talked about, yeah, so and the last big one being around what the value of defining what success looks like and how to measure it, like, long-term. I think that's the other big piece, like poor problem definition, right? I think that certainly negatively impacts the ability for a digital transformation to be successful, because it kind of sets up the roadmap, I guess, right? Like, we're here and we want to get to here, and here's how we'll know that we got there. If you don't have that properly defined, you'll end up in a completely different location than one you were expecting, than your technology partner was expecting, than your stakeholder were expecting. And I think that can serve to really derail an organization's willingness to undergo, you know, future digital transformation initiatives. They've been burned once, you know, they thought they were going to get this much value out of it or do the following, and they weren't able to. Like, now we're a little, you know, shy about getting involved in any other digital transformations. I think unclear problem definition is certainly one that can stand to kind of derail a transformation effort.
Yeah, good call. I want to shift the topic a bit to long-term versus short-term choices for technology, because I know that there are some use cases where an organization doesn't need to invest a lot of time and effort to make a short-term investment in tech versus usually you want to go for an RFP process or something similar to that if it's a long-term, many-year type of choice. So I'm curious to know, when would you see technology better suited in a short-term or a short-term vision versus a long-term vision? And I'll give you an example, like picking a CRM is probably going to be a long-term solution, right? But maybe a certain add-ons or other types of elements of technology might be, you know, let's just use it for a short term to get us over a certain hump and or a trial period of some kind before making a final choice for the long-term.
Yeah, this one is, I've gotten mixed views on kind of the short versus long-term. I understand the reason why short-term decisions need to be made when it comes to buying or investing in a particular solution. But I feel that in the majority, the bulk of those cases, that, I don't want to say, that rush or urgency to make that short-term decision could have been avoided with, you know, some real deep kind of longer-term strategic thinking or planning. That's what I'd like to believe, right? You know, in an ideal world, the team gets together in a room, they talk about kind of where they are now, where they want to be, what solutions are out there that should be looking into, and they can build a plan as to how they want to get there. That's ideal world situation. That does not, you know, it doesn't happen all the time. So what that leaves us with is situations where, you know, that level of rigor, the planning was not, you didn't have time to do it. And that leaves you with a situation where you've got to make a short-term purchase because you've got a pressing need or something that needs to be done just like right away, right? It's more of a, you know, you got to get this implemented because there's a time crunch or a budgetary crunch to get it done. I still think that you can kind of combat those situations with preparation and having some of those conversations, but I realize you're never going to hit 100%, right? The one thing I'll throw in there as well is, as we're starting to consider short-term versus long-term, what I've seen happen with a couple of my clients is there has been such a focus or lack of focus that they end up with many short-term solutions. And that's where you start hearing about things like shadow IT and, you know, oh, why is our technology budget so high? Well, it's because it's like, you know, 10 different people each went out and bought an application that they thought was going to solve this particular problem. And no one ever took a step back and said, maybe we can accomplish this with, you know, just one or two applications instead. So I think that's kind of the other pushback that I'd have on the kind of short-term mentality. It's, yes, it's necessary in some cases, but that doesn't remove from the fact that there should always be that time or set aside that time to think more long-term. That will affect your budget. That will affect how your organization functions on the whole. It will affect your ability to move data between systems, right? If you're not thinking with that long-term focus, then you can get in this spiral of always getting short-term things and missing it on the value of a unified kind of approach.
It sounds like you would favor long-term planning every single time for every scenario.
Is there I would like that. Yeah.
Yeah. So there's, but there, I'll flip the question then. Is there ever a scenario where you, where short-term is the way to go? It's the right choice.
Where short-term is the way to go and it's the right choice. So speaking from experience, the only time I've seen short-term, like we got to pull the trigger on getting this done now is, well, I've seen a few situations. When that level of planning hasn't been there, there wasn't an opportunity to put that level of planning or rigor around it. And it was like, we need the solution now. It's time constraint, right? Like, you know, this snuck up on us, you know, maybe somebody mentioned in the past, but we didn't really think about it. And now here it is, and we need to get it done, right? I've seen that drive short-term decision-making. And the unfortunate thing is I would say that the majority of time, this is just, you know, Kevin talking kind of ad hoc based on kind of what I've seen. The majority of the time, although you can get the short-term solution and it might do what the organization needs it to do, the lack of planning that goes in, that went into making that decision means that the end product doesn't fit as well with all the requirements that were actually needed. When additional thought was put into it, it was like, okay, yeah, we got this video conferencing software, right? We're using it, it's doing what it needs to do. But then you kind of get further down the road and you're like, oh, well, we actually need this video conferencing software that integrates with this and lets us record here and transcribe this. And as you start listing out those features, it's like, yeah, we got the short-term solution to meet that pain point. But by investing in that short-term solution, we didn't pay attention to all the other needs that we had. And now we got to kind of, it's almost in some cases, you got to go back to the drawing board and say, okay, well, now let's go out and start thinking about all these other things, right? And maybe that's just part of the process, Alex, you know, that learning process. Sometimes you got to go through that to help you articulate exactly what it is you need to get done. But I think, again, I think a lot of that stuff can be stymied by having those difficult discussions up front with all members involved, with all parties involved. Because otherwise you get people that are going out and buying applications on their own, you know, slapping their credit card down and just kind of doing their own thing, which works for them, but not for everybody.
There's also a danger that temporary becomes permanent in that you do that quick analysis or not even an analysis. You just, like you said, put the credit card down, you buy something, it works. It doesn't do everything you want it to do and it doesn't integrate with everything you want it to integrate with, but it works to a certain extent. And the appetite to spend time on reevaluating it, reassessing, and determining if there's a better solution isn't there, at least not in the short term. So you kind of live with the solution for a longer period of time. And then there's people who complain about it and they're like, yeah, we know, but no, no, no.
But, right. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And it's tough. I mean, it's tough because those solutions, they can get sticky, right? Like they stick in the organization. People are like, okay, well, it's solving this one thing. But then there's always that, like, there's that competing, you know, those competing factors inside that are like, hey, well, we're paying XYZ for this. It doesn't do a bunch of other things that we require the solution to do. Like, we get that you like it, team A over there, but team B, C, and D need the following additional features or functionality that solution doesn't offer. Then that's when you start to get into those kind of internal struggles and that aversion to change that we touched on before, right? Where people have grown with and have an affinity for a particular solution because, you know, they saw the problem. They went out and did, you know, some research. They went out, slapped their credit card down, bought it. You know, they're the rock star for the first, you know, 6 months, year, right? Because they got that solution. And then later on, that decision might be getting challenged by other folks, right? Saying, okay, well, we get that was good back then, but, you know, based on requirements, we need the following, right? And then, like you said, it can end up being tough to kind of get that solution pulled out.
Or even worse, you have one team that continues with the initial software, but a second team in a silo
does
something else. And all of a sudden, you got two systems doing the same or similar things.
Right.
And then at some point, you got a third and so on. And this huge technical debt that appears over time, that after a while, you're like, hang on a second. To your point earlier, we got all these systems that are basically doing the same thing. Let's kind of harmonize things, or let's see if we can harmonize things to simplify life and reduce costs.
You bring up a good point. This actually kind of touches on one of the questions you posed before. I should have thought about this. When you talk about, like, you know, like why some digital transformation projects, technology adoption projects fail, because I've seen exactly what you're talking about, right? Like, we like the system, we're going to keep it. Like, forget you guys, go do your own thing. At some point, and this is, you know, I try to approach this delicately. At some point, and usually you don't want to get here, But at some point there needs to be, I'll say like a line in the sand drawn, right? Where someone in a leadership or board level position can come in and say, okay, you know, this is the direction that our organization is going. Here are the decisions. Here are the reasons why we're going here. You know, here are the opportunities that we presented to help get you on board. But for whatever reason, you're still not feeling, you're still not liking it. At some point, I think there needs to be a cohesive decision that gets made towards moving in direction A versus direction B. And it's a tricky one because, again, I even talked about the fact that you got to be cognizant or respectful or tolerant of people's emotions and perspectives and, you know, aversion to change. But, you know, I said it again, at some point, if you keep doing what you've always been doing, like, things won't get better, right? And there has to be, at some point, there's got to be a decision that needs to get made and needs to be, I don't like this word either, but enforced, I guess. I'll use that one. That kind of dictates what the organization kind of mandate is and the tools and technology that will be used. Totally. And here's the thing, you know, it's not so far-fetched. I mean, you know, if an organization decides on, you know, an email platform or a CRM platform, you know, I'd be surprised to hear of, you know, a few staff members that are like, no, I know that you use that, but we're going to use this instead, right? We know you're a Google shop, but we're going to, you know, I like Microsoft, we're going to use it over here. It's like, no, of course not. Like, this is the organizational decision. This is the way we're going. I just think that conversation, that mentality needs to be, we got to remember that we put standards and things in place so that we can all move kind of in the same direction and not have to worry about, you know, competing data sources and applications and administration and all that other stuff.
Let's use the word, instead of enforced, strongly encouraged.
Strongly encouraged. I like strongly encouraged, right? I know. Well, I'm thinking about one of the organizations I used to work with where a lot of it was about like procurement policy, right? And, you know, you have to buy software and hardware from this vendor. This is the rule. But you still have people that are like, I'm just going to go to Best Buy and just go get my stuff over here. I'm going to go to Staples and get this over here. And it's like, you know, I'd get in these conversations with, you know, chief procurement officers and folks in finance and say, okay, well, we set up this great system for everybody to use it, but people still aren't doing it. Like, you know, what are you doing about it? The software can only do so much. Now we got to get into strongly encouraging people and putting the right incentives and motivations in place to stop them from doing what they're currently doing, which we all agree is to the detriment of the organization on the whole. It's a delicate conversation, but it's one that needs to be had when you get to that stage in the game, I think.
Absolutely. All right, last question. One of my favorite questions about tech is the shiny new toy syndrome. Any advice for nonprofit, especially nonprofit organizations, to avoid the shiny new toy? As you know, the shiny new toy today is ChatGPT and various types of AI. So, you know, what would be your suggestion to either avoid it, or should they avoid it, or should they just adopt it and just be one of the early adopters of this kind of new tech?
Sure. I wouldn't say avoid shiny new tech. So there's a difference between, I'm looking at this as a difference between like staying abreast of, staying aware of the shiny new stuff versus like leaning in and saying, okay, like this thing just came out. We want to get it installed. We want to get everybody on it like tomorrow kind of thing. There's a difference. There's different stages. I like when, you know, clients, staff, executive director, when the folks that I'm working with are coming in and saying, okay, like I saw this on, you know, I heard about this on a podcast, or I saw this, you know, on a blog that I'm staying on top of. I like when people are engaged in the conversation because that shows that they're trying to stay aware of how the tech industry itself is changing. And they're also trying to stay aware of how these shiny new things can impact what they do on a day-to-day basis. I think that's a good thing. Those are conversations that we should actually encourage. What we should be cautious of is when there hasn't been enough rigor put around or research put into those applications, and it's a move to, this looks really cool, we should get this tomorrow, right? That's where it's like, okay, well, wait a second, because I'm running into this with a client right now where it's, look at this, this tool looks like it can do everything that we do. It's awesome, it's great, it's new, but it's like, okay, well, wait a second, that's cool, I like that you're thinking about that, let's talk about your thought process that got you to look at this application and what you like about it so much. But let's also talk about the strategy that we put in place and why we are moving towards using a different application, a different platform altogether. I think those conversations can happen so that they don't deflate from looking at shiny new things and actually encourage folks to look at shiny new things, but making sure that those conversations are part of the broader strategy discussion, which we've talked about probably ad nauseum on this call. But I think it's important to make sure that, you know, you look at the shiny new stuff, but also make sure, like, how does the shiny new stuff fit into what the overall plan is?
I agree. Informed, but not actionable yet.
And it's good. I mean, I don't think it's just you and me, but I mean, people get excited about new stuff. That's cool. I think that's a good thing, right? There's nothing wrong with that, with going out and looking at things and trying things out and, you know, seeing what ChatGPT could do, seeing what plugins are available for it and where it can be infused in different applications, you know, staying aware of, you know, ChatGPT's relationship with like Microsoft and what's going on there and who else is looking at, you know, AI tools that could be infused into their system. All that stuff is really cool and awesome and really exciting. You'd almost be surprised when people aren't as excited about it as, you know, as propeller heads, but, you know, to each their own, right? I think it's a good thing to try and encourage people to have those conversations, to bring new ideas, to talk about it openly and honestly with, you know, their fellow staff members and with the IT consultants and stuff like that. But, you know, also making sure that it's part of the broader discussion, right? It's not a knee-jerk reaction to, you know, this looks really cool, let's get it. It's part of a broader strategy or a platform play that I think is more beneficial in the long term.
I completely agree. Kevin, this has been great. Thank you so much for joining me today. Where can people get in touch with you and find out more about you and what you do?
Yeah, sure. So I got a little site set up. I mean, we're Green Merits Consulting. Green, like the color, Merits, you know, synonym for value, MERITS.com. And yeah, you can reach me. You know, I've got contact page, Calendly, if you want to schedule time to chat with me and just talk about some of these things, right? My approach is one of like an advisor, right, or coach on these things, especially with the smaller nonprofit organizations who, like I said, you know, they might have a tech support person, but that tech support person, in some cases they do, but not in all, they're not necessarily aligned with kind of like organizational strategy. It's more of a break fix role, which is completely understandable. Others, I think, are getting more on board with, you know, getting much more ingrained and involved and hearing out the business kind of organizational challenges and talking about technology roadmaps and strategy. That's the advisory service that I provide, kind of broken down to three things. Helping to research, right? Like, I don't know what I don't know. Where do I start? Like, who can I bounce some ideas off of? Here are some things that I heard about the shiny new toys or the, you know, the old solutions. How can I talk to somebody about it? The next piece is around, help me adopt it. You know, I'm thinking about putting together an RFP. I'm on the cusp of signing a contract. I've got demos set up with vendors. Can you help me out and advise me? Can you join some of these calls? Help me, you know, review the contract terms and stuff like that. Then the last piece is around data analysis, right? So I've got all this data coming into this system that I've since acquired and I've been using for the past 6 months or a year. How can I make sense of the information flowing through it? So I provide advisory services on all those things. And just try to help out nonprofits with really getting their arms around what it really means to undergo a digital transformation and how, you know, we don't need to be afraid of the technology or apprehensive about it, but if we approach it from a methodical, value-driven perspective, it can actually do a lot of really, really cool things in partnership with our technology providers who are doing amazing things from a technical perspective too. So www.greenmerits.com, or if you want to toss me an email, it's kgeorge@greenmerits.com.
And we'll put those links in the show notes below. Awesome. Kevin, man, thank you so much for joining me today.
Alex, this was a great conversation. Thanks for having me. I appreciate it. I hope a lot of folks get value out of what we discussed too.
I hope so too. Let us know. All right, folks, that's it for today. I'm Alexander Lapa, and I hope you join me again in the next Agents of Nonprofit.